And we're back live from Beto O'Rourke's campaign headquarters.
Which is apparently J. Crew, based on that VF cover.
That cover was...
something.
Was a little... I wish he was smiling. Is that... I mean, that's like such a thing to say to a woman. But something about the look on his face, I was like, do you know what's happening?
He was giving us the... I'm the rugged candidate. Don't you see a dirt road beneath my feet? Don't you hear the Springsteen?
Look at the dog.
Yeah. Oh, a dog's in it.
Well, so it was written by Joe Hagan, who wrote the profile of John Edwards that was in Men's Vogue, if you remember that magazine.
I remember the cover because someone tweeted out that they were very similar.
Very similar,
just sort of like, here's this man that we want to introduce you to. And it's sort of funny because it's like Obama became that. Like, you'd expect him on the cover of Vanity Fair and Rolling Stone. This is like kicking off with, here's my campaign. Yeah. I am the celebrity candidate, which he was. I mean, celebrities were pouring money into that Texas Senate race.
Yeah. Can I tweeted this, and I would maybe amend it to 2 years, but I feel like people aren't thinking about what this actually means. I would give up a year of my life. I'd be willing to die a year earlier to fast forward immediately to the end of the 2020 election.
Oh, please.
Where's Phil Keoghan when you need him?
Like, and maybe 2 years. And people were like, you'd have to give up more than that. I'm like, are you guys realize, like, two full dying 2 years early is like a lot. But I think I'd definitely be willing to die a year early to be done with it right now.
Even on a cheap artificial level, I swear I'm done with the jokes already. Like, I've already, whatever, like, Kamala Harris joke I can make, I have already made it. You know, Elizabeth Warren, I've already compared you to Jane Curtin. I have nothing left.
Plus, like, I thought I was going to be worried about Bernie fans, but I think
existing.
since I don't have Facebook anymore, I don't know where they are. But the Bellets are here.
Is that what they're called?
That's what I'm calling them. Just in my comments, I'm ready for Beto. You're not from Texas. You don't know. I'm like, okay, girl.
See,
I donate it.
Fast forward.
Back in the day.
That's what I'm saying.
Now it's just like, there's also just so many people in the race. I don't know who I'm voting for. Also, can you chill out and like let us get to any debate first? Find out what any of these
people
are
after. We need to start culling
after
these people down anyway. So it's like it doesn't even matter to you, because every sensible, remotely responsible person with any sense of moral values come fall 2020 is going to get in fucking line with whoever the Democratic candidate is. So, like, I don't even need to have these arguments right now because I will vote for the Democrat.
Yeah. No,
if I'm not an asshole.
If we pick Garfield, you better believe I'm voting for Garfield.
Exactly.
Maybe even Nirmal.
Like, why do we need to fight over this right now? Why are we fighting over this?
Also, we live in L.A., and the people we're arguing with live in, like, New York and other big cities like this. We're not the people who are going to decide who is going to be the Democrat who's running for president. It's going to be those people that they always find on the news who are always like, well, I don't know who I'm voting for.
Right.
I'm going to decide in the booth.
No, we live in a place with we're surrounded by people who know who Betty Who is. We can't be trusted to pick what the rest of the country understands.
Guys, speaking of a female icon.
How kind of you.
This is a good segue. Guys, I brought in what I had promised you. What I'm holding in my hand are two posters from the movie Greta.
You guys,
your favorite feature film of the year so far.
Isabelle Huppert's face has never been bigger, nor have the hearts in my eyes right now.
So I got Ira and Lewis both Greta posters so they can remember how much they loved the film.
Honestly, the film that I've talked about the most this year.
I don't believe I've given any thought to any other one besides Gloria Bell starring Holland Taylor.
Yes, and Holland Taylor will be chatting with me in this episode about Legally Blonde. We get into The Practice.
Oh, yeah.
And we also talk about The Edge of Night, a 1960s soap opera that she was on, and she was very shocked that I knew about it. But you two know me.
Yeah, so nothing.
Neither of you are shocked.
I just picture Holland Taylor saying the words "at the edge of night," and I'm lit up.
Should we replace Rami with Holland?
Oh, that would be perfectly acceptable.
Yes, you know, I was debating like, who are we going to replace Rami with? Every time we take a photo and put it online, someone tweets at me, "I see Rami's still there."
Wow.
They are mad.
These Where's Waldo detectives just checking out the back. Yeah.
We will get rid of him.
Maybe we should crowdsource. Should we crowdsource or do we care?
Should there be a national contest to be the face we replace him with?
Wait, why don't you email keepit@crooked.com and let us know who you think should replace Rami Malek on the Keep It poster. And
it is a prominent part of the poster.
Like it is. It's a big head.
Yeah. Significant real estate.
Speaking of big heads.
We'll be right back to talk about the college scandal, which is raging on. Black Stories, Black Truths. It's a celebration of blackness from NPR and how I live my life every day.
Oh, I'm glad to bear witness to it.
Each of NPR's black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of a struggle.
It sounds like you at Coachella. I'm already tuned in. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be black today, told from a unique black perspective, from Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations. There's no limit to the range of black stories, black truths.
Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as very nuanced and black as the country we reflect. Stories should never be about us without us.
Doesn't the black experience sound like a 3-disc Prince album we never got? Someone check the vault, please. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR wherever you get your podcasts.
So, earlier this week when we talked about the college admission scam, I somehow missed the fact that it was called Operation Varsity Blues.
Who was it? Who indicts people? Who did this?
The Department of Justice. Operation Varsity Blues.
That story already made me feel like I was high as a kite. And then when I saw that, I just assumed it was a hallucination.
I love that James Vanderbeek tweeted about it, too.
Right.
What did he say?
He was like, if only there were something that these kids could say to their parents to let them know that they don't want the future that they want from that.
Which is a reference to that meme thing that people always post. I don't want to be you or whatever it is.
It's I don't want your life.
That movie, by the way, is garbage.
Varsity Blues.
Yes, it's terrible. I remember the whipped cream scene, and I remember the stripper scene really well.
Well, yes. Yeah,
so, you know, high school shit.
Yeah.
Varsity Blues is a very boring movie, and I think it's only made iconic because of the whipped cream scene, which is replicated in
Not Another Teen Movie.
With Chris Evans.
Right, which is
much better scene.
Right, cuter.
Yeah, than Ally Larder.
We'll put that to the public
from whipped cream to Idris Elba. Anyway,
oh God,
this scandal is raging on.
Did you see the courtroom sketches?
I was going to bring it up.
Lori Loughlin.
Excuse me,
Felicity Huffman.
It is my pleasure to describe Lori Loughlin in the courtroom sketch to you. First of all, it's evil Aunt Becky hair, by which I mean straight.
In the glasses.
Big black glasses, Goldblum style. And she is wearing the whitest turtleneck. Like, she is here to ruin your Nancy Myers movie, sweetie.
the press photos of Felicity Huffman in her glasses. She like unable to even exit doors because there's just paparazzi swarming.
Well, the other thing was, so Lori Loughlin, who, by the way, gun to my head before this broke, if you would ask me what Aunt Becky's name was, there's no way. She was like on a plane. And so there was all this drama because her, she was flying back into the United States and her lawyer was like, I just need to talk to her first. And they're like, that's not how this works, bitch. Like, we are arresting her when she lands on US soil. And so I love to imagine her sitting in first class, knowing good and goddamn well that she was about to be in handcuffs when she stepped off the plane. But like the narrative made it seem like she left on purpose.
No,
you know what I mean? It seemed like she was like fleeing.
Yes.
But it, that wasn't it.
She was in Canada shooting for Hallmark.
The Hallmark Channel.
I love how one of the articles lightly shaded her because it was like, we assume she was in Canada because Loughlin is a staple of Hallmark's movies.
Rough. How wasn't there like hashtag when will Aunt Becky land? I'm just blown away we didn't actually like capitalize and get all the material we needed from that.
I want to know where the videos are of the people who were on that plane and knew that she was flying back there.
But I wonder if they knew, right? Because they were on the plane. And so unless they had internet, they wouldn't have known what was happening.
Yeah. Well, that's, right. I just picture her walking around with like a Stoli Martini, Blue Jasmine, Tizzy style, like waiting desperately for, you know, trembling with that Cate Blanchett tremble.
Well, Lori is actually one of the funniest parts of this entire thing to me.
I thought you were going to say she's one of the funniest parts of Full House. I was like, I don't know about that. Go ahead. Jodi Sweetin really killed it.
I never say that, dude.
Oh, God.
It's my Mary-Kate.
Let's keep it going. Yeah, yeah.
And or Ashley.
Right.
Who knows who did which scene?
Never Elizabeth.
I need an investigation.
Mm-hmm. The horse accident? Never forget.
Leave Marcy May Marlene alone. So her daughter, Olivia Jane.
Yes.
Is a wannabe influencer
right.
on YouTube and Instagram, and people were just digging up her tweets. Where like, in 2017, she tweeted, "It's so hard to try in school when you don't care about anything you're learning." On YouTube, she just talked about how she was going to college for game days and partying, and continued to reiterate how much she does not give a fuck about school.
Right. She also clearly is so stupid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which what I love so much about this scandal is that their parents knew that their kids were dumb enough, where even the tutors, even donating money, like the normal things that rich people with dumb kids do to get their kids into school, their kids were too stupid for that.
Yeah.
They had to go a step further and literally commit crimes. That's how dumb their kids were.
Right. Well, also, It requires millions to donate, like, to a wing or a building. Like, at USC, like, people are dropping
a lot
coins.
Of it, yeah.
That is a lot of rich-ass kids at that school. $500,000 ain't gonna get you shit. So Lori was like, we gotta do a scam.
The sports stuff is the funniest part of this.
Photoshopping people onto athletes?
Yeah, so basically, like, one of the things that they did was trying to get the kids in under the guise of them being athletes. You know, it's easier for them to get into school, more of a legitimate reason to accept them. So they were not only bribing the athletic, like, the coaches of, like, the crew team, but they were photoshopping their kids into pictures of them playing the sports to be like, look, he's a water polo star. And I guess at one point they bought like water polo gear. They have like the Amazon records of them buying like equipment to pretend that they were athletes.
That is so shocking. That's all the evidence they need. Like, here's a photo of them seeming to participate in a sport.
Which makes me question whether or not the kids did know.
Right.
Because we're supposed to believe that the parents were going about this without the kids knowing. If your parent is buying water polo gear or making you take photos with it, something's going on.
There is in the EW write-up of the best parts of the scandal, one of the emails, I think, from Lori Loughlin says that she did forward Olivia Jade on one of the emails and was asking, like, she's having trouble with her application. She's confused as to how to apply to the school or something, only reiterating, maybe this girl is pretty dumb.
When Olivia Jade found out about the scandal. Did you read that part?
Yeah.
She was on the yacht of someone on the board of trustees at USC.
And also the guy, he like owns the Grove.
Oh my God. So he's my
like
hero.
The mall. A perfect mall, but still.
Yeah. Y'all had all these fucking connections and you couldn't get your girl up in school.
You know, Mr. The Grove.
So what do you think? What do we think William H. Macy? Like, do we think he was just really like he didn't? Do you think he really didn't know or he just was smart enough to?
I think there's no paper trail with him. I think he was too busy shooting Shameless to send emails. He probably doesn't know what an email is.
But isn't there like a transcript where he's listed as spouse?
There's something where it says spouse, but I don't think that they have
enough
evidence to indict him.
Got it.
Because what if Felicity Huffman goes to jail? Goes to jail for lying to get her dumb kids into college.
I know. It does feel like someone picked a randomizer of like the millions of celebs who do this and just landed on Felicity
Huffman.
It was
such a weird, she's such a weird one because also, that's what, in particular with USC, like, you're one of, I would say, the top 25, like, Hollywood power couples.
Yeah.
Like, you're both very famous, well-respected actors. I'm like, you couldn't offer to do a guest lecture series.
Yeah.
You know, like, William H. Macy couldn't have taught some damn acting classes.
Natalie Portman's on Masterclass.
Like, yeah.
Like, right.
I don't understand how that particular combination of people would have such a problem getting their kids into USC.
Right. It's inconspicuous. No one's like, I wonder how they got into USC. No one's going to second
guess.
You're
like, oh, that's Felicity Huffman's daughter. That's why she's at USC.
Right. And also, Felicity Huffman, smart person. Of course her daughter would be capable of getting into USC. I'm not even thinking twice about it.
Also, try for NYU or something, or like any other school. It's the schools that they were trying for were very weird.
But I mean, USC and NYU to me are like a similar, it would be just as weird if they did all of that for NYU to me.
True.
So like all of
NYU
it.
NYU does not take scams. Okay.
Oh, did you check?
You need sheer talent.
Bitch, please. All these, listen, every school on this list,
now,
they are being scammed.
Now is the winter of our discontent.
Oh, were you given a scholarship to go away or what?
I was doing some Richard III for you.
Heard of him? I know who she is.
Heard of him? Yes, that's how I got detained.
I want to see the limp. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I am actually wondering if any of them will go to jail, and it might seem crazy, but I also remember that Martha Stewart had a stint in jail. It is not shocking for our white women celebrities to have a jail stint.
Also, there are black people sitting in jail right now, literally for shit like changing the address on their, like, their official address to, like, get their kids into better schools, which is, like, the, you know, it's like, oh, this is so funny.
Right.
And then quickly people were like, this is actually super dark because, you know, one, it's like how, like, if you're a black student at, you know, an elite university, it's like you've definitely had someone say some affirmative action, something about you being there
because of
affirmative action and that kind of thing. And it's like, this is the ultimate affirmative action, what rich people do to get into these schools. And like the idea that students of color have gotten in because of some quota, when it's like there are more legacy students at Harvard than there are black students. It's like, give me a fucking break.
Right. And legacy students were initially created, you know, in order to keep people of color, to keep Jewish people out. Anyone that, you know, was undesirable because you could just plant in, you know, people who you know that they have a good bloodline.
Yeah.
This story feels to me like it is a benign diversion in certain ways, but there is, like most benign diversions, if you think about it for more than 5 seconds, you realize, oh, wait, this is deeply shitty.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, it should just be reiterated. Even though all these celebrities are capable of paying to get their kids into college and like no one has questioned it for a long time, this is fucking vile. I mean, it is disgusting behavior that we allow these people to like thrive and get people into schools who don't deserve to be there.
What's also disgusting is the fact that so much of the rhetoric, especially like from the U.S. Attorney and other people talking about it, is how gauche they find it that they went to scamming, like they resorted to scamming. They were like, why couldn't you be like the rest of us rich people and, you know, buy a building or donate some money? It's like, what's worse for this for other rich white people is that they didn't do the right way
right.
of trying to get their kids in.
We wrote a manual about how to do this and you won't follow it.
The other thing that I find so bizarre is you have Olivia Jade as your daughter. She's a dummy. She's rich. She doesn't actually like she doesn't really need to go to college for her to have the life that you want her to have, which is to continue to be rich and like privileged. Like Yolanda Hadid bought her kids new faces and sent them all off on modeling careers. They didn't pretend like they needed to go to college. It's like she didn't actually need to go to school to continue the privilege of her life.
Right. You think you're telling me Olivia Jade's not dropping out of that school in what? It's well, 18
that's
months.
That's the thing. Now, do you think the kids are going to stay in school? Because it feels like they have to leave.
Well, I feel I think that Stanford or one of the other schools rejected the applications of people currently applying.
Who were currently embroiled in
this. And other students will be, you know, a case by case basis. I guess it'll be digging into. Did they know? Like, are they actually a good student?
But it's also like it's false information. So whether or not they knew, if they got in based off of falsified information, it feels like no matter what, whether they, you know what I mean? It feels like they shouldn't be allowed to stay, but, you know.
I know, it's weird, you know? And I feel like people are considering them and these poor children more than they're actually caring about people who actually go through things in this country.
Well, yeah, because they're rich white kids.
Yeah. And I do think that they'll get like a slap on the wrist, to be honest. Most of them will probably plea out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Also, you ever think about how much better Full House would be if Aunt Becky were evil? Like, let's say, you know, the episode where Comet gets lost. What if Aunt Becky were like, and I hope he stays lost. And then they just never dealt with her being evil. She was just an evil character. You know, like Alexandra from Josie and the Pussycats, just like constantly scheming.
I can never actually remember if Aunt Becky was... I know that she had her flirtation with Uncle Jesse.
Yeah. Well, no, they got married and they had the kids.
Yeah. They got married. Okay. Did he have a previous girlfriend? Maybe she killed her?
That's what I'm saying. I want to get into the edge of night shit with Becky. Yeah.
Well, speaking of the edge of night, coming up next, my interview with Miss Holland Taylor herself. I am here with the wonderful Holland Taylor. I have...
From your mouth to God's.
I have been a fan for years. I loved The Practice. It was one of my favorite television
shows. I did, too. That
shows.
Was one of the greatest parts I ever was lucky enough to get.
Yes, Judge Kelsen.
You know, that developed over years. It was just a small part of a very telling scene with Regina King, I think.
The first
time I... Wow, you're on it.
I've been rewatching some of it now that they added it to Hulu.
And well, David Kelly had seen his wife's picture, whatever, that one fine day that I played her mother in. And I had a very flirtatious scene. I mean, it seemed flirtatious. I wasn't flirting with George Clooney. And David said that woman could give the daughter a run for the money for George. And so he got this idea of making the judge really a sort of a sexual, an active, you know, 50-ish woman who was out there.
I know. One of your few episodes is just when you tell Dylan McDermott that you had that erotic dream about him was hilarious.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I particularly loved the one where, we won't go into detail. I can tell you I would get scripts late at night when I'd come home. I came home one night really late, and I got the script in which she has the line, "I gave him the greatest blowjob in the history of mankind." And I read that at like 2 a.m, and I had nobody I could call to tell. This was in 1999, you understand.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm going to say this on national television. I finally called up an actress friend in England, because she was at least awake, to tell her I had this extraordinary scene to play. They ended up changing it to fellatio, but it was still pretty much out there.
I think that was around the time, like, they had nudity on, like, NYPD Blue, too.
Probably.
Yeah. So.
Probably. But I think it was the fact that I was an older woman that made it that made it sort of newsworthy at that time.
Yeah. Well, it was a great role, and I love that show.
It was. David's been very good to me with roles.
Yes, that, and this is going to... I wasn't old enough to watch it, but
I'm sure I was old enough to do it.
not The Practice. I mean, I'm a big soap opera fan.
Oh my God.
I still watch Days of Our Lives.
Only on for 1 year.
Yes, but I watched, I've seen clips of you on The Edge of Night.
Oh my God. You know, I wish I had, I guess they're still available, aren't they? You can get them somehow on YouTube or something.
I watched part of a scene on YouTube today.
Because, oh, you're kidding.
Well, yes, I'll show it to you.
I only did that for 1 year.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't, I mean, I needed to make a living and I took it for 1 year and the character was very popular and they wanted to continue, but I just thought, I can't. I can only use the excuse that I needed to make some dough that year and then I had to get off it. And that was the year, the next year was the year they started actually really paying people for doing. So that was the end of that era. But the character was so evil, she was both... She died of natural causes and was murdered by her father on the same day.
Yes.
You remember that?
Yes. It was because it was Edge of Night was a crime soap opera. Yeah. It was mostly like trials and things. Yes. And your father, it was like a mercy killing because you wanted to keep your husband and his lover apart.
Oh, God. So murder.
Yeah.
So the answer to that problem is clearly, well, you have to murder her, I guess.
Yeah, kill yourself and frame him.
Yes, right. Yep.
Were like a lot of, because you were in theater then, a lot of theater actors taking soap opera roles back then?
Oh, my God, yes. I mean, theater has never really been a living wage. Mm-hmm. First of all, you're never in it. 365 days out of the year, unless you happen to be in a very long run. So it's not steady work, and it doesn't really pay that well. So you have to do other things. And I also made... No, I didn't. By the time I did... when I did Bosom Buddies, I stopped doing...
Mm-hmm.
No, yeah. I stopped doing commercials at some point.
Okay.
I just thought, I can't, no matter what, do that, so...
Can't sell yogurt or anything anymore.
No.
Do you remember, like, a commercial that you're really like, I can't believe I did that?
I actually did one of those Madge ones with your fingers in the palm olive. Somebody remembers. I did one of those. As you can see, my hands, you'd think that all that ridiculous. I have gardener's fingernails, but no garden. So. Mm.
I loved... your theater work, particularly, I love that you did Anne.
Oh, that was...
it was a... You wrote it.
Yes.
And you starred in it about Anne Richards.
Yes.
And I'm a big fan of her as well.
That was really a mission. That was not a job.
Okay.
That was something that... I mean, I wrote that play. I started that work when I was 65.
Mm-hmm.
And I was possessed with the idea of doing something creative about her because I was so upset by her death, which seemed very untimely. She was a very young 73. And, and she was just gone in the twinkling of an eye. And she was one of those figures that I had thought would always be there in my life and in America's life because I thought she was one of the greatest inspiring figures for America we had. And I just couldn't get over her death, and it seemed very odd to me. It was though it was personal.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I had that thing happen when you are obsessed by something emotional, you want to do something creative about it. So that's how that happened. And then the whole execution of the thing, I developed it in 6-7 theaters before I got it to Broadway, before we got it to Broadway. And it was very costly in every way to do that, and it was like bringing up a child. I mean, it had as much meaning for me. It was the most meaningful act of my life, unquestionably.
Yes, I think people don't truly realize how expensive it is to just to do theater. And, it can be, you think of it as such a big, booming business, but that's because of, like, Wicked and
But when we were on Broadway, that was a different matter. I mean, I wasn't producing that. Bob Boyette, who is a legendary Broadway producer, was the producer there. But I had to develop it in big theaters in Texas. And, you can only make money on a theater run if it runs for a period of time.
Yeah.
And I did short runs in Galveston, Austin, in San Antonio, in Chicago at the Schubert Theater. I did those things before we were a Broadway production.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would... we would only play for 10 days or a week, the normal kind of tour period of time. You cannot make a dime on that. So, I mean, the first set I had made for Anne was $125,000. So it was like, you got to run a little while to pay that back. So, so that it was costly in that sense to develop it before Bob Boyette took it on. But she's such a huge character. It required an enormous, fabulous set. It was a big production. It wasn't a little black box thing that I could develop in tiny theaters at all. It was something big.
Yeah, I mean, such a big character and woman who really, I feel like we revisited a lot because of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. I mean, that entire race of hers where she was up against...
George W.
But then
well, Karl Rove. She was really up against Karl Rove is who she was up against, because that's where he cut his teeth on the really dirty tricks of a campaign politics. I mean, he really did unbelievably shocking things behind the scenes against Ann Richards in that campaign and advised his candidate, George, to always be very, very polite and gentlemanly. With Anne.
Yes.
It was very, very shrewd directions all around.
And then specifically Clayton Williams, too.
Oh, before that. Well, he shot himself in the foot.
Yes, with the rape comment.
Yes, just lie back and enjoy it.
Yeah. You know,
rape is like weather. Rape is like weather. Just, sit back and enjoy it. Yeah, totally.
I remember Cecile, her daughter, was just talking about how the Hillary debates with Trump reminded her so much of the debates with...
Absolutely. There is one debate with George, which I just... it's so unpleasant. It makes me so unhappy to watch it. I can't, because she was so... She was such a true character. She was a true public servant. She had a kind of nobility to her. And that, in combination with that wonderful, vivid, feisty persona, was just unmatchable in history. She was such an attractive character. And she had a hell of a temper. And I know her staff, and I know her kitchen cabinet, and I know her administration very, very well as a lot of her very closest friends who are one and the same. You know, her anger was so, her temper was so in the service of working hard that she was always forgiven. I mean, it was always understood. It was never small. She was not a small person. She was a very big person.
Yes.
And, you know, we filmed the production in a live performance.
Yes.
And it's on Broadway HD now, which is, it's always available, which is really moving to me, because I wanted her voice to stay. I wanted to do what part I could do in keeping her voice in the American air.
Well, that's fantastic. People should watch that, because I saw the Ann Richards documentary, and that was on HBO.
Yes.
But I would love to see the production now on Broadway HD.
Well, Broadway HD is just like Netflix, only it's for plays.
Okay.
And it's the same kind of platform that you subscribe to for a month or something. It's like $8 a month or something. And there's a lot of wonderful plays on it. I mean, it's the wave of the future, in the sense that I think from now on, every production that is successful is going to get filmed well to preserve it. I mean,
I miss living in New York and getting to see plays all the time.
Yeah.
And I actually went to NYU to get my master's in playwriting.
Really?
Yes.
And do you write them?
Yes, I do TV now out here, but I do plays from time to time.
Well, it's a wily animal writing a play.
That's how I found out about Edge of Night, actually, because I wrote something that was set in the late 70s, and I needed a soap opera, and that's what I found yours on YouTube. Speaking of women in general, I remember when you were on The Practice, you just talked about how David gave you such a great role for an older woman.
Yeah.
And now seeing you in this new film, Gloria Bell, by Sebastian Lelio, who I love.
I love
A Fantastic Woman was one of my favorite movies.
And it deservedly won an Oscar.
Yes. Yeah. And now Gloria Bell is a sort of reimagining of Gloria and older film that he did.
Yes.
Have
you seen that?
I have not seen the original, and now I need to.
Definitely see it. Quite different in tone.
But okay.
It's really wonderful. You know what I love about him as a filmmaker is he puts things in the frame and allows your eye to find them. The clues, the important things that you're supposed to notice about what has transpired. it's just in the frame, and it's usually lit in such a way so that your eye will go to it. But he doesn't, like, zoom a camera in on something he wants you to see. He's not that bossy an editor. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so the film really unfolds before you, and it was so effective. I saw it with an audience last night at a screening, and it was I realized the tempo of his films, the slow revelations of behavior. You really become very watchful. You're looking for everything. It's so affecting.
Julianne Moore is so fascinating in that film, and your scenes together, you know, they're just so wonderful and nurturing. And it's nice to see just two women sharing the screen like that and how they're just allowed to exist. You know, he did that with the trans actress in A Fantastic Woman. And it's just, I heard that this Gloria Bell is a bit more comic than the original one in tone.
It is in a way. I think the script sets up of some jokes more. But again, I think it's more really a very quiet and real story where you get to know a person without having who they are shoved at you. I mean, he's a very relaxed storyteller in that way, which I really enjoyed. And the editing, like, for instance, the last moment when I probably shouldn't define it exactly, but the moment he chose to cut to end the movie, I thought was inspired because it was just at the moment where she gone. That's all you have to see.
Yes. And that's how a Fantastic Woman ended, too.
Yes.
It just feels very...
Yes, like, whoop,
here it
there
is.
It is.
Yeah.
Click, we're gone.
And so speaking of how you spoke in interviews, how you loved that role on The Practice, how do you feel like time... has changed sort of in Hollywood for older actresses?
Well, older actresses are always slighted, and I don't know. I mean, the wife knows. Glenn just had that awful experience of probably everybody in the world telling her she was very likely to win that Oscar, which, of course, she certainly could have done. But that was quite a wonderful older role. And, the great actresses like Judi Dench and Helen Mirren play these roles, and the films are always just huge successes. So I hope Hollywood understands that it's not just older women who are out there wanting to see older women. It's everybody wants to see the full range of, you know, human life. And Hollywood is sometimes the last to know the obvious truth, which is that, you know, all people are interesting.
No, I mean, it's wild. I mean... also coming out soon is Greta, this film with Isabelle Huppert. And it's funny.
Have you seen it?
I have not. Someone was, Richard Lawson from Vanity Fair was joking that the plot of it is like Chloe Moritz is terrified that Isabelle Huppert is obsessed with her. And I'm like, who wouldn't want that?
What's the problem?
I would love any of those actresses to be obsessed with me.
Right. Got it.
But yeah, you know, it's really fun seeing that you have been able to do just such a breadth of roles, you know, where it's even from Two and a Half Men, you know, to the L Word, you know, where it's just you're playing older women who are fun and like real characters.
Or you actually have lives.
Yeah.
I'm doing a character on Mr. Mercedes now, which is on audience TV, which I do not know what the viewership is on that platform, but it's with Brendan Gleeson, who's one of the great actors of this world, the great Irish actor. And this character, too, is an older woman who is a widow, and she lives on her own. And society would say, well, she's no one, you know, because what is she? You can't quantify her. And the fact is, 100 years ago or so, I did a play on Broadway called Butley with Alan Bates, and it was about this teacher in an English university who's just come to a crossroads in his life, and he just feels done. He's having a mental breakdown. And there was an article, and I was his wife. I just had one scene with him where obviously the marriage was on the rocks. And the New York Times wrote, this must have been 1980 or something, an article, could there be a play about Mrs. Butley, who had no identifiable role in life? And the answer was no, that there couldn't be a play just about a woman. So you had to have some reason for existing that had to be connected to a man or some truly rare heroic thing, like, I don't know, you know, the Madame Curie.
So
you had to either be Madame Curie or involved with a man that made her valuable and interesting.
Or had a goblet trying to kill a man.
Exactly. So it had to be either epic. You couldn't just be a person who had a life that could be revealed.
Yes. You know, you are so active on Twitter. I have to ask you, are there favorite people that you follow? Like, who do you look forward to seeing come across your timeline?
Well, I like Lawrence O'Donnell, and okay. I like Clive Barnes. I follow them because I think they're both so shrewd, and their their take on affairs of the day is always fascinating to me. But I just follow a lot of people, a lot of show business people, a lot of friends, and I started at when I was actually on the road with Anne because it was sort of company when I was traveling, and then I got hooked, I guess, on seeing those favorite opinions, but also I picked up a lot of news from it because whatever a lot of the people I follow were yakking about was going to be interesting to me. And I actually think that I should sort of stop relying on it for news the way that I did because there's something happening in Twitter speak that is getting a little bit... It was a lot more fun. It used to be more fun than it is now. And now most of my friends are on Instagram, which I like because it's all about pictures.
Yes.
But Instagram for me so far has been hard to learn how to wrangle. Okay. Whereas I know how to do Twitter.
Yeah.
And but I'd like to get switched to Instagram because
I love Instagram. The favorite part is the stories because you can just sort of give people a quick burst of something fun and then it's gone in 24 hours.
Yes. Some stories you want to be going on 24
hours.
But interestingly enough, I don't look at people's stories that much.
Okay.
I wonder if there's an algorithm for figuring out on Instagram whether people watch the stories as much as people who post them might assume.
My stories are like memes sometimes clips of soap operas that I'm watching.
If they're short. Or if I'm avidly interested. But mostly I look at the still pictures and read whatever the caption is. But it is where people put up perfectly gorgeous pictures.
Yes.
And I think that's what's wonderful about it.
Mm-hmm.
And do you know Tony Baker comedy?
No.
Look up on Instagram.
Okay.
There's somebody I just discovered on Instagram I'm addicted to. He's a very funny guy.
Okay.
He posts videos, animal videos or people videos where he does the voices.
Okay.
And he does the conversation as he thinks it should be held. It's very, very funny. Tony Baker comedy.
I will follow him. Listen, I would be remiss if asking. Reese Witherspoon has talked about Legally Blonde 3 is maybe happening.
I ain't heard a word about it.
Professor Strawwell needs to be back.
Well, I told them that. I mean, actually, we share a hairdresser, Reese and I see her once in a blue moon. I see her at awards ceremonies, usually where she's usually carrying a statue. I said, is it happening? When I saw her the last time, she said, it's happening. She didn't know when. I guess she's probably booked quite heavily. But when her hairdresser, Lana Vigie, was cutting my hair one day, I said, tell Reese that if I am not a Supreme Court justice by now. But wouldn't that be great?
It would be.
I mean,
especially now.
Right. Strawwell could, there's a number of years have passed. She could have retired from her professorship role and become a full-time judge and get appointed to the Supreme Court of her state, at least.
I think I definitely.
The frickin' United States.
Yes, I want Elle Woods going to the Supreme Court and trying a case in front of you.
First of all, how can you not have such a reprise of that character, given that she was so influential? But also, that scene, the first scene in the courtroom, in the classroom, is a really... I watched it not long ago. It's a really fantastic scene. It was so well directed.
I still love so much about the movie. I rewatch it all the time.
I do, too. It was very... Robert... I can't remember his name. It's Ludekic or something like that. He was a very nice, very sharp guy. And there was also a great director of photography.
Robert Luketek.
Luketek.
Yeah.
And there was a director of photography on that picture who was a very, very star director of photography. He was wonderful.
Yes, well...
So I love that picture.
We will start a campaign on Keep It Here to get you in Legally Blonde 3.
Yes!
Because it needs to happen.
Yes, do it. I just did the Roger Ailes picture that Jay Roach directed, and that was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. I sort of played... again, there was this movie is filled with a lot of actors who are playing tiny little roles just to be part of that whole world. He's such a great director, Jay Roach. And Roger Ailes is going to be a very interesting figure to see. I can't wait to see this movie to
understand
the whole picture.
So we will get you Legally Blonde 3, we will get you an award for it too.
No, because, no way.
Listen,
no way. Let's not
I love
ask
your that. Award speeches. I your Emmy speech well, is one of my favorite speeches.
That was, you know, as I walked up to that stage, I was wondering if I said that. I said, I'm literally climbing the stairs and I'm thinking, do I dare just say overnight? What if I just don't get it and I'm just standing like an asshole?
Yes, because you walk up and you're like, and you raise the statue and you're like, overnight, and the audience loves it.
There was a beat. There was a beat. You see it on film, you see this little pause, and I'm thinking, okay, just think for a second, folks. I got it. Because I was 50-something then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was pretty great.
Thank you so much for
thank
being
you.
Here,
thank you. You're a wonderful interview.
Yeah, so nice
thank
to
you
meet
very
you.
Very much. Lovely to meet
just,
you.
Just you looking great, too.
Like, thank you.
Holland came in here with a vintage Chanel scarf, just serving fashion, and that is what we love here.
And bedhead.
You were fabulous.
This is what you get, is this hair.
We'll gladly take it. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.